You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a head coach and a player from Wisconsin pro women's basketball team that's about to play for their league championship this weekend. First, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation came to an end earlier this year. His report did not find sufficient evidence that Donald Trump's presidential campaign illegally coordinated with Russia to influence the 2016 election and didn't take a clear position on whether Trump obstructed justice, saying they didn't have the capacity to charge him with that. The Mueller investigation itself might be over, but it remains to be seen if the president is completely out of the woods. There are still a lot of ongoing investigations facing the president, including ones tied to his personal finance, his business, and his foundation. Paul Nolet is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Before we dig into some of the specific ones, can you give us just an overview of the scope of the investigations facing the president, his business operations, and more?
Yes. So these are very, very wide ranging, and they cover, some of them anyway, cover the issues that Bob Mueller, the special counsel, was looking into, including obstruction of justice and, you know, illegal collusion between Russia and the campaign. Other ones look at Trump's business practices, and a lot of these actually predate not only when Trump was president, but even before he started his campaign. So there's a wide range of issues that are still out there, and somewhere around 30 active investigations or lawsuits into these activities. And so these are going to be continuing for quite some time.
That first part of what you just mentioned sounds a lot like what Democrats in the U.S. House are doing following up on what came out of the Mueller report. How are House Democrats proceeding now, post-Mueller?
Yeah, so there's a few issues that the House of Representatives is involved in, both including the business practices and the follow-up on the Mueller investigation. And that includes issuing a number of subpoenas to people mentioned in the Mueller report. So ever since that was released, the House said, you know, regardless of what Mueller does, we're going to follow up on these, investigate, issue subpoenas. So actually just last month, the House sent out, issued a number of subpoenas to people mentioned in the Mueller report, something like, you know, two dozen of them or so. And so they're following up, gathering more information to try to supplement the record that Bob Mueller put together.
One of the big questions for House Democrats is, are we just doing normal oversight here? Are we doing an impeachment inquiry? Some people want to actually start impeachment proceedings. What is the division, the balance of power on those three different approaches?
Yeah, I mean, there's not really a clear line between what is an impeachment inquiry and what is, I guess, quote unquote, regular oversight. So a lot of the discussion now has been between the more liberal part of the Democratic caucus who wants an impeachment inquiry and Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, who says, you know, we should put the brakes on that. But in some ways, the breadth of these investigations in the House make it seem like there's already an impeachment inquiry, even if not by name, that's currently going on in the House, because of, they are looking at a lot of different things. Again, both what Mueller was looking at and dealing with Trump's business practices.
Talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University about investigations facing President Trump even after the Mueller probe. Paul, what we were just talking about there in the House, that's the headline stuff, but there's a lot of other stuff going on in states around the country. What are some of the ones you're focusing on, especially ones that pertain to the president's taxes and business practices?
Yes. So there are a number of state attorneys general, particularly the New York AG, where the Trump Organization and other Trump businesses are based, that are looking into a variety of potential fraud. And again, some of these investigations, including with the Trump Foundation, go back several years. And they're looking at things such as, did some of Trump's businesses engage in tax fraud? So illegal tax diversions and such, and were they filing illegal insurance claims? Were they just generally involved in things like campaign finance violations? There's a lot of different threads here that the New York AG's office is looking into, as well as some federal prosecutors in the U.S. District Court in Manhattan as well. So the House is one thing, a lot going on there, but there's plenty going on in the states as well.
Right. And Michael Cohen's testimony before Congress, this is President Trump's former personal lawyer. He suggested that the president and his business were giving different numbers for the same property to, say, banks they were trying to get a loan from, to tax authorities, giving lower numbers. They paid less taxes, different numbers to insurance companies. That's the sort of thing, if you had all the right paperwork, you could match up and see if something fraudulent was occurring. Is that what some of these authorities in New York might be looking at?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, there was a big investigation by the New York Times last year that was completed that looked at a huge amount of information pertaining to Trump's businesses. And one of the big claims here, it's very complicated, but the big claim was that particularly Trump's father, when he turned over pieces of the business to Donald Trump, devalued a lot of the assets that he was turning over. So he was able to save millions of dollars, and that could be a fraudulent transaction right there. So that's just one example of what they're looking at. So, some of this has already been put together by organizations like the New York Times, but certainly investigators have a lot more tools at their disposal, including subpoenas, to get this information and try to piece it all together.
That's the Trump Organization for the most part. How about the Trump Foundation, the president's now dissolved charitable organization? Can you talk about why it was shut down in the first place, why it would still be looked at now?
Yeah, and so here there's real questions about illegal coordination between this foundation, which after all is supposed to be a charitable organization, and the Trump family and the presidential campaign. So one of the central pieces here is, was the foundation involved in illegal coordination with the presidential campaign? Was the foundation used as a way to generate money and other resources for advancing the campaign and Donald Trump's political prospects? And that sort of thing would break a number of charities laws. And I will say that the New York AG's office has a very, very powerful charities investigatory team that is digging into this stuff as well.
When we look at the Trump business, the Trump Organization, which is actually a bunch of businesses, and the Trump Foundation, if they're found culpable of wrongdoing, what are the possible consequences for a sitting president who is part of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's important to break that down in a couple ways. First, there are criminal investigations ongoing, particularly in the Southern District of New York. So a federal investigation. The Department of Justice has already said that a sitting president can't be indicted on criminal charges. However, after Trump leaves office, this could be very relevant again, because after all, Trump will be a private citizen and could be subject to these criminal indictments. But even as a sitting president, a lot of the state investigations, like the New York State Attorney General, those are civil investigations. And the U.S. Supreme Court has actually been directly on point, saying that a sitting president can be subject to civil litigation. So things like insurance fraud, campaign finance violations, and that sort of thing. So that could actually happen sooner rather than later, or at least when Trump is still president.
In a civil case, though, if I lose a civil case, it's going to cost me money probably. It's not going to put me in jail, though, right?
Yes, that's correct. So I think in terms of jail time or that sort of penalty, you're looking more at the criminal side. And that's something that, again, the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorneys are extremely unlikely to indict a sitting president. But on the civil side, nevertheless, a lot of information could be generated, including even the president's tax returns.
A lot of presidential candidates might not want to talk about this, say, hey, we'll let it run its course in the courts. The president, though, he's talking this up. He says, hey, witch hunt, they're all out to get me. Hey, look, it's New York, it's California, states like that. Can you talk about the president's strategy actually using these cases against him?
Yeah, and I think he's saying, like you just mentioned, he's building up a case that, oh, this is a big witch hunt, all these people are out to get me. And it's, Democrats, essentially. And he's also portraying a certain type of confidence, saying, I'm never going to settle any of these cases. I'm never going to give up. I'm going to fight these all the way to the Supreme Court, those sorts of things. And that very well might be true. However, in the course of discovery, where a lot of this information is going to be generated, there are a lot of potential landmines for Trump and his close associates and family here.
One of the biggest ones seems like it might be, I think I saw a couple cases involving the Trump Organization's use of undocumented workers, abuse of said workers, and somehow these workers obtaining fake documents, allegations about the Trump Organization's involvement in that. Given the president's message on immigration, is that a potential landmine, as you just mentioned?
It could. It certainly could be, both in terms of the financial culpability there, but I think even more importantly, the fact that it muddies his overall immigration message if the Trump Organization was involved in that sort of activity.
Do we have any kind of timeline on when the shoes would drop on these various investigations?
It's hard to say because a lot of the, particularly on the criminal side, they're still investigations. And so those could, are generally out of the public eye for this point, and they could drag on for quite some time. However, I mean, some active litigation has already occurred. And in fact, the lower courts have been pretty open to the idea that Trump cannot just shut down subpoenas that are issued by the House of Representatives or prosecutors. And so a number of those cases are on appeal. So I think we're going to hear from those cases probably in the next, potentially even the next 2 or 3 months, we're going to have some action on that. I think the criminal cases are going to be quite a bit dragged out over the next even year or two.
Wow. And over this next year or two, there's this election thing going on. Do we have any sense of what the public thinks about this? Are they are people going to be swayed by what comes out of these investigations? Is there investigation fatigue, if that's such a thing?
Well, I think people's views of Trump are very locked in. I mean, it's quite amazing how polling has shown approval, disapproval ratings of Trump have been very consistent throughout much of his presidency. I do think that, at least on the edges, there's some potential that some bombshells, even if they're, say, financial fraud, not the high-profile Russia investigation type of things, but financial fraud, that could bite into Trump's self-image as fighting for, or making America great again and kind of fighting for, the non-elites that have never had a role in Washington and such. So I think this really has a potential of muddying his message in the lead up to the presidential election next year.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
Paul Nolet is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He joins us to talk about investigations into President Trump post Mueller report. The perfect 12-0, that's the regular season record of the Wisconsin GLOW professional women's basketball team. The Oshkosh-based GLOW just finished their inaugural season in the Global Women's Basketball Association at the end of July, and this weekend the team will play in the league's championship tournament. It's being held at their home court, Menominee Nation Arena in Oshkosh. On the line now we have the GLOW's head coach, Dan Carey. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
And Racine native Sam Logic is a guard for the GLOW. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us.
No, thanks for having us as well.
Well, congratulations to both of you, first of all, on this perfect season. Dan, take us back to what it's like to set up a brand new team, finding the talent, bringing them together, and forming into an unbeatable unit, apparently.
Yeah, it's been amazing. Obviously, huge credit to our general manager, Brad Fisher, for putting this team together. And our players have been incredible. They're so unselfish, and the way that they've come together so quickly with limited practice time and a very unique game schedule has been amazing. And it's just a testament to who they are as people and players. Like I said, incredibly unselfish group, and really a pleasure to coach.
And Sam, looking through the roster, there's a lot of Wisconsin talent. Some players like you are from Wisconsin, or you're from Racine. A lot of players had played at UW-Madison, UW-Green Bay, and elsewhere. Talk about the Wisconsin connection that you and your teammates have.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us have actually grown up either training together or playing against each other. Not many of us, besides our Green Bay crew, have played together too much. And like Coach said, a lot of us just, with being high IQ players, I think, overall, and unselfish, it came together pretty quickly with like clicking offensively and even defensively. So it's been really fun so far.
Dan, can you tell us a little more about the Global Women's Basketball Association?
Yeah, so we're a four-team league. It's been established for a few years, and you know, we're looking to grow and expand as we move forward with really quality franchises and with good fan bases. And just want to give – there's so many women that are so talented and love to play and still want to play, and just giving them the opportunity to play to supplement, you know, what they do overseas playing, you know, for the majority of the year. This is one avenue that they can have. And we really think we're going to be able to grow this and expand as we move forward, heading into next year.
And Sam, what kind of response have you gotten from the Fox Cities region?
I mean, I think our fan base has been awesome. Besides St. Louis, who's been a franchiser for like 6 or 7 years. I think we matched them in attendance, at least as far as I could tell. So it's been really fun, obviously, having a lot of people, you know, girls from Green Bay, and being successful at Green Bay is helpful for the team. But, you know, a lot of times, I mean, like Coach said, we play overseas for 8 or 9 months out of the year, and our families, you know, go from either having the chance to watch or listen at some point for our 4-year career in college to not watching us at all, maybe watching a stream online, you know, in a 7 or 8 hour time difference. So I know my family and friends are really excited to be able to see me again. I mean, besides my family, no one's seen me play live for 4 years or something like that. So I think it just creates a lot of buzz, like Coach said, and letting us come back and, you know, play in front of family and friends is truly a blessing for that.
And Sam, where have you played overseas professionally?
I played 1 year in France, and then I went to Australia. My third year was in Austria, and last year I was in Slovakia.
Dan, do you see women's basketball in the United States maybe picking up more steam, more respect, maybe to get to a point sometime in the future where American players will spend more time playing in the United States?
Yeah, I really hope so. I think that's the dream, right? And you know, I think it's definitely attainable. It's just going to take more and more people and more communities to financially back what we're trying to do and back these women, because they deserve it. I mean, this has been, like Sam said, I mean, just it's been amazing seeing, you know, the support with their family and friends, being able to see them again. Like, this is what they should be able to do, right? And they should be able to do this year round. There's no reason that it shouldn't be this way. And we love that we're able to give them an opportunity like this. And we really think, I think as we move forward, there's definitely an opportunity, because there are so many incredible players, and that's not stopping, across the country, that deserve this chance to do this, and to do it in front of their home family and friends, for sure.
Sam, we mentioned it's a four-team league. I know you've played some games outside of the league as well, but you're going to see the same teams, the same players again and again.
Yeah.
Does that give you some sense of rivalry as you go through your season?
Well, I think so. And I mean, what they say, it's always hard to beat a good team, or, you know, three times. And so, you know, that'll be the case. The championship game, obviously, it's win or go home. So, we got to take care of our business on Saturday to even get to that point on Sunday. But, I mean, when you start to know the players a little bit more, know that personnel, it can become like that. But again, it's just playing basketball and playing basketball the right way. And, that's what I think we've done all year and have continued to grow doing that. So, like I said, we'd like to finish it out on Sunday with a win.
And Danielle, or that playoff coming up this weekend, is preparation for the championship a little different than the regular season?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, everything gets ramped up. This is what you play for, and we're expecting. I mean, we're going to get we've been saying this for weeks now. And once we, you know, started off strong, became a known commodity, that we're going to get everybody's best shot, and we have. We absolutely have, and we're expecting that this weekend. But we really, truly believe we have not played our best basketball yet either. And I'll take our best over anybody else's best any day of the week. And we're excited to do that this weekend in front of our home fans. It's going to be a tremendous challenge, but I know our players are going to rise up to it. And they're an ultra-competitive group, and I know their competitive fires are going to get stoked pretty good this weekend. And we're excited about it.
Sam, a lot of attention to women's sports. We've got your league. We've got the women's team success in the Soccer World Cup. I have a couple young women athletes in my own household. Do you have thoughts for girls and young women who are playing sports, maybe thinking of getting into sports today?
Well, no, I mean, I say do it. Try everything. Whatever it is, I mean, basketball, soccer, softball, volleyball, swimming. I mean, try a little bit of everything if you have that opportunity. I mean, it's a great place to learn life lessons and obviously staying healthy, like being physically active and stuff like that. But there are so many things that, you know, you learn through sport that just later in life are just going to be make you that much more successful. So, like I said, try anything. I played almost everything growing up, at least for a season, just trying it out. But it's been obviously a huge part of who I am and who I'll, you know, continue to grow into be. So I couldn't speak highly enough of trying to get into something, find your passion in something.
And as we wrap up, Dan, your hopes for the team. This is the first season for the team. You got the championships coming up. What are you hoping for in the future?
Yeah, I think we're just kind of scratching the surface. We all want to see this be something that is sustainable over time, and continue to give these amazing women this opportunity to continue to play and to play at a high level and form new friendships and connections and play in front of their family and friends. So, we need support. We need crowd support. We just need people to get behind us. And we really think that this is an amazing thing that we're just getting started with. So please, you know, for everyone listening, come out and watch us Saturday at 7:00. And then hopefully if we can get a win, we would play Sunday at 3:00 up in Oshkosh. You will not be disappointed. You can ask anybody that's come see us play this year. It is an absolute blast watching this team play, and very family friendly environment as well.
So. Dan, thanks to Dan and Sam. Good luck running the table this weekend. We've been talking to Wisconsin GLOW, their logo is a firefly, head coach Dan Carey and GLOW guard Sam Logic. We talked to him about the team's undefeated season and upcoming playoff tournament this weekend. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is joining a bipartisan coalition of more than 40 attorneys general. They're calling on the streaming industry to limit tobacco use in their video content. In a statement, Call said they are, quote, asking streaming services to take steps that can help save lives. Last month, the group Truth Initiative released a report showing that many of the top streaming shows popular with young people depict smoking prominently, and they say that's putting kids and teens at risk. Barbara Schillo joins us now. She's vice president of the Truth Initiative's Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Studies and was a contributor to the group's recent report, While You Were Streaming, Smoking on Demand, A Surge in Tobacco Imagery is Putting Youth at Risk. Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, before we get into smoking on streaming in particular, what do we know about the connection of kids, young people, seeing smoking on a screen and being influenced to maybe try it themselves?
Well, we actually know quite a lot. There's really well-documented research that shows that exposure to smoking imagery directly influences youth smoking behaviors. And we really applaud the 46 attorney generals who signed on to that letter that you mentioned and really cite this very research showing that according to the Surgeon General, youth with more exposure to tobacco and movies are twice as likely to begin smoking compared to those with less exposure. And we know that relationship is causal. And that's why we here at Truth and many of our colleagues and allies in this effort together really care about the findings that we saw in our most recent research.
Let's take this, into the streaming world and this report. A lot of people have watched that we get our content by streaming on Netflix or Hulu or whatever. What did you find when you looked at the original programming coming from these streaming services?
Well, so here's what we did. We took the 13 most popular shows with 15 to 24-year-olds, and we coded complete seasons, the most recent season available, and we coded those episodes for tobacco imagery depictions. Could be an individual cigarette, a pack, or other tobacco products. In the analyses that we've done so far, primarily what we're seeing is cigarettes. In the most recent report that we've released, in the 2019 report that was just released last month, found that 92% of the shows that are most popular with young people in this age group on both streaming and broadcast and cable outlets depicted smoking prominently. And that was up from a previous study that we did last year. In 2018, we first did this research. This recent report is a new release and an update to those previous findings. And what we're finding is that there's actually an increase, a 16% increase in the percent of shows showing depiction. And if you break that down, it translates into some incredible numbers. You know, approximately 28 million young people having been exposed to tobacco use based on what we estimate the viewership of these 13 shows to be.
I understand one of the big culprits was the very popular show Stranger Things, which has a pretty strong youth audience. Can you talk about what you saw there?
Yeah, that's right, Rob. And we released this report back in the early part of July, right about the time that Netflix was releasing Stranger Things. And what we saw is that the first two seasons of Stranger Things had tobacco depiction in every episode. Season 2, which was analyzed and presented in our most recent report, showed 262 tobacco depictions compared to 182 in Season 1. So, and this is before, of course, the release of Season 3. You know, we'll see what that looks like in terms of moving forward. Netflix, content on Netflix represented sort of our list of top offenders, with Stranger Things topping that list, but then followed by The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Orange is the New Black, and The House of New Cards.
Talking to Barbara Shillow from the Truth Initiative's Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Studies, looking at the impact of the portrayal of smoking and other tobacco use in media and pop culture, especially shows targeted at younger people. Barbara, some people might say, okay, a show like Stranger Things that's set in the 80s where more people smoked, as I dimly recall. You could look at a show like Mad Men where they showed people smoking a lot. Is there an argument to be made, hey, it's just depicting the reality at the time the show is covering?
You know, certainly there is a case to be made for historical depictions, but we think the instances that we've coded, that we've seen and analyzed, are pervasive and go way beyond historical accuracy. I mean, back in the days of Mad Men, yes, 50% of adults smoked, but not every adult smoked. And so again, we feel that there's room in all of this for historical accuracy and historical depictions. But what we're seeing is well beyond that in terms of content the amount that you're seeing in the streaming content.
We've seen some specific calls for change from your organization and from that letter we've been talking about from attorney generals, including Wisconsin's own. They want, among other things, streaming services to eliminate or exclude tobacco in imagery in all future original stream content for young viewers, including any content related TVY through PG-13, and ensure that content with tobacco imagery receives a mature rating. What do you think of that idea?
Yeah, if you look at our report and our call to action, if you will, many of the recommendations that are outlined by the attorney generals mirror or are reflected or match closely with those that we call as well. I mean, clearly content is being produced and delivered differently than how it was in the past. And we know that 87% of 15 to 24-year-olds are accessing their content online. In fact, 61% of young adults report that online streaming is the primary mechanism for how they're viewing their entertainment. And so we really need to stay on top of these streaming services in terms of the call for action here, as there's a responsibility, clearly, for the health impacts that they have for their viewership.
You've mentioned that age range a couple times, 15 to 24. Why is that such a key age range to worry about?
Well, when you look at tobacco use, typically the majority of tobacco users are established tobacco users by the time that they're 26. So this is the period of initiation. This is the period in which youth are susceptible to the renormalization, the glamorization of tobacco in the movies, in streaming content. And so this is a particularly important age in terms of how we view this issue.
In your report, I think you described the presentation of tobacco use in these shows as, in effect, free advertising for the tobacco industry. Can you talk about that?
Well, certainly. You know, we have made tremendous gains over time in reducing the harms of tobacco, in particular among youth and young people. We have combustible rates of tobacco at historic lows, but those didn't happen by accident. We had diligent efforts, concerted efforts to really look at how tobacco has been depicted historically and made some real progress in the past on TVs and movies. But as, again, content and production of entertainment has changed, we feel essentially that this is giving the tobacco industry essentially a free ride. Content has become, in some ways, the new tobacco commercial, and we worry about this pervasive reemergence of smoking imagery across screens. Again, that's glamorizing and renormalizing a deadly addiction. I think it's a reminder for all of us that care about this issue and care about the health of young people and future generations that we can't sit back as technology changes, as culture changes. We're forever challenged or continue to be challenged to do right by future generations.
We're talking right now with Barbara Schillow of the Truth Initiative's Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Studies, talking about the relationship between tobacco imagery and popular streaming shows and movies and tobacco use. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is one of many AGs across the country signing onto a letter calling for a change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this when you watch shows on TV, streaming, or network? Have you seen more tobacco use depicted maybe on the shows you watch? Does it bother you at all or not? Do content creators, do the streaming services have a responsibility to crack down on these depictions or maybe put on warning messages? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Barbara Schillow of the Truth Initiative's Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Studies. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has joined a bipartisan coalition of more than 40 attorneys general calling on the streaming video industry to limit tobacco use in their content, and we're finding out why that is. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you watch your favorite show, streaming, or new stuff on networks, do you see a lot of smoking or other tobacco use? Does it bother you? Do you see it being harmful to your kids? Do you talk to your kids about it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We had a caller, Lucy in Wapaka, who couldn't stay on. She wanted to ask, shouldn't it be on the parents, their responsibility to talk to their kids instead of making a company like Netflix make these changes? What do you think, Barbara?
Well, certainly, we know that parents are incredible influencers for their the young people they're raising, their children. But it shouldn't fall on parents alone. We know that as we work together, as a community, as a society, to address the sources that contribute to tobacco use, we all benefit. And so parents are dealing with a lot, and absolutely, we always are in the position of providing parents with information and education how to talk about their kids, but we think that that role extends beyond parents to the larger community and to the larger public health community, medical community, if you will, in this case, to the media industry, the media community.
And we have the report out from your organization. We talked about that, and we have this letter from attorneys general. Have you heard from Netflix or other companies about possible changes in the works?
Well, we did see some positive movement after the release of our report, and we want to applaud Netflix for their response in stating that they'll dramatically reduce smoking imagery in their content. But we are cautiously waiting. They haven't posted their guidelines yet, and we look forward to seeing the details of that policy, how it will be implemented, and then, of course, of how it will be enforced. So more to come on that. Again, we're certainly encouraging. It was encouraging to see their statement, but we need to see how that comes into actual practice.
As you mentioned earlier, the report from your group isn't just about the streaming services. What did you find when you looked at network shows that were popular with this younger audience, the 15 to 24-year-olds? What kind of shows stood out as worrisome when it came to tobacco use?
Yeah, that's a great question. So tobacco incidents on broadcast and cable programming have also dramatically increased. We saw our top 2019 offenders in this category, Once Upon a Time, American Horror Story, and even Modern Family. And it's not just Netflix in terms of streaming. We also saw Amazon's award-winning The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Hulu's Gap Year also topping our list.
Talking to Barbara Shillow from the Truth Initiative's Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Studies, looking at the impact of smoking use in pop culture on young people, young potential smokers. They have a new report out, and attorneys general, including Wisconsin's, signed on to a letter asking content providers to change things, to show tobacco use less on their shows. Another caller couldn't stay on the line, wants to know, are tobacco companies providing funding for these shows or services, kind of like how cigarette companies used to sponsor shows in the past?
You know, this report does not address this, and so, so I don't necessarily have an answer for that, but I think the streaming companies say no, this report didn't really set out to answer that question. But clearly, when it comes to imagery in all pop culture, this report focused on streaming, but we also have a series of other forums or formats for popular culture, including looking at media, video games, social media, in other content. And so the producers of those platforms, we believe, also have a responsibility, as does the industry in all of this, to ensure that young people are not being inundated with this kind of imagery.
Let's bring on a caller now. Ben is with us in West Salem. Ben, hi.
Hi. I was just listening to the conversation earlier, and I somewhat agree with what the lady being interviewed is saying, but I would just wonder, the content that you would like Netflix to help you moderate, and like possibly Amazon or whoever, this content that I'm observing and seeing as I'm downloading and watching stuff is well beyond the scope and range of the children that you're trying to not to smoke. You know, these there's open, sexual acts and violence well beyond the range of a 10 to a 16 to 15 year old child who's, really the main source you're concerned about, it seems, before they get hooked. And I guess I would just ask how she would respond to that.
Ben, thanks for the call. So maybe these are shows that younger people shouldn't be watching for reasons unrelated to smoking, Barbara.
Yeah, well, great question, and thank you. You know, our report actually confirmed that the increase in tobacco depictions was greatest in content that was directed at TVY7, so younger than 7, and TVPG. So we found 176% increase in tobacco depictions for these shows overall, but it was a 379% increase in youth-rated programs when compared to previous year's data. And that's what's most troubling for us, is that, youth-rated content. So I think a good observation and a good question, but our study really shows that this is an incredible level of exposure for programs that actually are designed for younger people.
In our last few minutes, Barbara, do you worry that if tobacco is normalized by being in shows like the ones we're talking about, it's going to turn the curve the other way? It could ultimately lead to losses in our anti-tobacco efforts?
You know, we certainly worry about anything that has the impact to undo all the gains and successes that we've had in reducing the level of harm to young people caused by tobacco products. So the studies that we've done so far have focused on combustible cigarettes, and that's what we've seen through the seasons that we've coded. But as we move forward, of course, e-cigarettes comes into play, and we anticipate that we'll see more depictions there. And so the attorney generals are right to call out in their letter that this is a particular concern given the increase and the rise in the use of e-cigarettes that is surging among young people in particular. And so, yes, we remain concerned about the depiction of combustible tobacco. And then I think we also are concerned extremely about the possible, increased prediction or depiction of e-cigarettes.
Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today. That's Barbara Shillow from the Truth Initiative Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Studies, talking about pop culture and tobacco use. Wisconsin's startup industry lags behind neighboring states, but Milwaukee's technology community is hoping to build on some small successes. Corrine Hess reports.
Moments before a recent wedding show in downtown Milwaukee, members of Jared Judge's string quartet were beginning to panic.
Didn't check to see if there was a set list.
A member of Judge's quartet was in a minor accident. Her car was towed, and inside was all of the music the group needed to perform.
We're just solving that problem right now. BookLive has our parts on it, so we're going to download them and print them right here.
BookLive is a social networking app that Judge developed with a partner while in grad school at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Because that's the dream, is you just show up, play, and collect a nice check afterwards. But the reality of it is you have to learn to be a business person, too.
The lifelong musician also happened to be a self-taught computer programmer. BookLive looks similar to LinkedIn. The app helps other freelance musicians manage their schedules and keep track of their finances. It's free. And when a performer is paid through BookLive, Judge receives a portion of the transaction fee. So far, about 500 people have signed up. Matt Cordio is the founder and president of Startup Milwaukee and Startup Wisconsin. He says freelance musicians face the same challenges as startup companies.
Leveraging his experience kind of being a musician has been able to build this really great technology company that we hope obviously continues to grow and expand and scale way outside of Wisconsin.
BookLive picked up steam last year, winning competitions at UWM's Lubar School of Business and also gaining the attention of Milwaukee angel investor Jim Miller. Miller has invested $100,000 in BookLive. That set Judge's experience apart from a lot of entrepreneurs in Milwaukee. And Miller wants to change that.
The people with money have not invested in this community. They've gone to safer havens where entrepreneurs and tech-savvy people have proven success.
The Kaufman Index of Startup Activity has consistently ranked Wisconsin and Milwaukee near the bottom in business creation and growth compared to the rest of the country. Metropolitan Milwaukee ranked 39th in 2017. That's tied with Pittsburgh for the lowest ranked major metropolitan area. That same year, Wisconsin ranked last for larger state rankings. The state also ranked last in 2016.
You know, if you look at Silicon Valley, I mean, they invest millions and tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions. So even our bigger companies have been very, very modest in their investment here.
Miller says Judge's company intrigues him because the concept can be done anywhere in the world and translated to nearly any profession. Miller is one of the founding members of Xywave. That company was started in 1995, and with about 300 employees, it's one of Milwaukee's most successful technology startups. By comparison, Verona-based Epic has about 9,000 employees.
When you compare Dane County to Milwaukee County, we're not even on the map.
Cordio believes Milwaukee needs to be doing a better job of telling the rest of the country its success stories, the way Madison has. Cordio says there is untapped talent in Milwaukee, and some companies are beginning to take notice. Madison-based American Family Insurance plans to open an office in downtown Milwaukee.
Because they realize there is tech talent here, and we are in under, I think, at times, appreciated market.
Milwaukee may never be thought of as a destination for budding entrepreneurs, but the city's tech scene is growing, and boosters like Miller and Cordio believe the trend is likely to continue. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new report from the United Nations says agriculture faces a lot of threats from climate change, and changes to food and farming could be a big part of the solution. We'll talk to a Wisconsin expert. Mexico is calling on the U.S. to protect Mexican citizens in the U.S. after the mass shooting in El Paso. We'll find out more about the response from the Mexican government. And on Food Friday, Wisconsin is under a severe zucchini advisory, leaving cooks wondering to do with it all. Our guest has recipes and advice. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.